Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Just one guest today, Greg Grandin, author of a new book called Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman, which was published at the end of August by Metropolitan Books. Not only is Greg, whose day job is as a professor of history at NYU, an amazingly prolific writer, he has an amazing breadth of interests as well. He was on this show in March 2014 to discuss his book Empire of Necessity, an exploration of the history behind Herman Melville's great novella Benito Cereno, a study of the contradictions between the vast slave trade that was foundational to American capitalism and the official promises of freedom that were foundational to American politics. And now he has a new book on Henry Kissinger, a figure of substantial influence in the world and not much of it good for five decades. Although this is not a short interview, there are many things about Kissinger's career that we didn't discuss, like his complicity in the massacre of a couple of 100,000 in East Timor, or didn't discuss deeply, like his support of white supremacist regimes in southern Africa. Grandin covers these in the book, which is highly readable, despite its often macabre content. In the interview, Grandin mentions Operation Condor without defining it. Condor was a coordinated scheme by right-wing dictatorships in Latin America during the late 70s and early 80s to repress dissident leftists, unionists, peasants, clerics, and intellectuals that resulted in the deaths of scores of thousands. The principals were the governments of Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, Paraguay, Bolivia, and Brazil, with the occasional participation of other Latin governments, all with the technical and military assistance of the United States. Henry Kissinger was at the heart of it all. And now here's Greg Grandin. Before we get started on the substance of Henry Kissinger, I just finished writing a book about Hillary Clinton, and as I hit send on my email program, I thought, man, I need a rest cure and a purgative of some sort. What's it like to be immersed in the life of somebody like Henry Kissinger for a year or two?
Well, it's pretty harrowing. He was really much involved in everything from the 1950s. I mean, one way or another, either as an intellectual or a policymaker, from the 1950s to the present. So I guess there's a way of anesthetizing one's sensibilities by thinking that you're really writing about the larger history. I mean, there's nothing in that he's not involved in that isn't also part of the second half of the 20th century, which is disastrous in so many ways. So one does feel like one needs to take a long hot shower after engaging with the man.
One, of course, wants to look at large structural forces in history and politics, but also he is such a substantial figure who's been involved at so many turns and with such craftiness and intelligence that it's kind of hard not to fall prey to the great man theory, isn't it?
It is. And in part of the book, I try to explicitly set what I do off from what Christopher Hitchens does. And I use Hitchens' polemic as an example of what Charles Beard, a great historian, progressive historian in the 1930s, called the devil theory of war, that looked to blame war on a single isolatable variable, a wicked man. And Hitchens does exactly that. His book is a devil's theory. And it's useful in the sense that it assembles the docket, but it really does preclude thinking, and it's an example of a certain kind of, I mean, we could argue about whether Hitchens was of the anti-imperialist left, but there is a way in which the anti-imperialist left dumbs itself down by not thinking about larger, how these individual transgressions and evilness, you know, are part of a larger system. So I tried to explicitly say that was what my book was doing. It was using Kissinger not to blame him for everything that has happened since the 1950s or 1968, but as a way of revealing and illuminating that history. But it's difficult because Kissinger was implicated on an individual level in all of these horrors. So it was a little bit of a tension.
Yeah, well, he's such a substantial figure and an actor. You know, he's not just a theoretician. He just set so many pieces into motion.
Yeah.
But let's start at the beginning. I mean, he's got a long history, going back to his undergraduate thesis, right?
Yes, I mean, he has a long history. I mean, even before that, he was an army intelligence in World War II. He was a refugee from Nazi Germany, from Bavaria, a small town in Bavaria. Came to New York. Really was a product of the meritocracy. Used the military, used the GI Bill as a way of moving up and ascending, which, of course, is admirable and in some ways exemplary of a larger post-war democratization of society. In the 1950s and 1960s, he becomes very much influential as a defense intellectual. But even before that, what I try to do is go back a little bit earlier to his very, very lengthy 400-page undergraduate thesis. This isn't even his more well-known graduate PhD thesis on Metternich and the conservative settlement of post-Napoleonic Europe. This is his undergraduate thesis, which was a philosophical meditation on a number of continental and British philosophers, Toynbee, Kant, and Spengler primarily. And, you know, it's fascinating. I don't try to use that as a gotcha Rosetta Stone that explains everything, you know, like a conspiracy, like I found the document that explains it all. But it does kind of illuminate the misrecognition of Kissinger as a realist. You know, when we think of that polarity that American policy is often discussed as idealists who believe that values like human rights and democracy should motivate U.S. action in the world, and realists who say that we should just defend our interests and have an understanding of our power, Kissinger is often understood as a realist. And he's not. He was very much influenced by a kind of German strand of irrational idealism. Often we associate with Nietzsche, but in Kissinger's case, he gets it a lot through Spengler, Oswald Spengler, a German, I don't want to say historian, because he just kind of made it up, but historian slash philosopher that argued that, you know, there are different realms of knowledge or wisdom that isn't reducible to rational knowledge. He called it spirit and civilization. And he was a very pessimistic theorist that understood civilizations as rising and falling. And Kissinger very much embraced Spengler's critique of civilization, especially when we can identify the moment of its decline, but rejected Spengler's determinism. And in this way, Kissinger was very much of a kind of post-war existentialist. He believed that history had no meaning, other than the meaning we gave it as individuals, but he also believed that there was a range of action and freedom, as he called it, that individuals could intervene in history and stop the decline.
But he fits somewhat oddly into American culture in that, you know, he's got this kind of can-do Americanism about him, but also a Central European gloom.
Yeah, well, that's part of the argument. The argument is that, you know, other biographers have figured him as somehow standing ajar to the American experience, either not believing in America, human rights and democracy, being more suited to European cabinet diplomacy of the 19th century. And one of the arguments is that he's the quintessential American. And the implied argument there is that American exceptionalism at its core is a form of irrational subjectivism, you know, a will to power subjectivism. That is what American exceptionalism is. And that's why Kissinger is the quintessential American. He's different from others in the sense that he was very much aware of the philosophical underpinnings of his diplomacy and his actions. So that's what makes him a useful person to study in depth, because that awareness allows us to kind of unpack and get at some of the foundational premises of that irrationalism and that subjectivism.
Parenthetically, the German accent has long been part of his shtick. He's been in the United States for a very, very long time. I believe his brother explained the persistence of his German accent by saying, "Henry just doesn't listen." And his brother, I think, has no accent at all, a very, very slight one. But did he really play that up to give him some sort of, you know, like Central European heaviness?
Well, certainly that's the effect it has, whether he intentionally did it or not. I've heard that story about his brother losing his accent. People love to tell that story. It's a Bavarian accent that comes out of his town, Furth, which was a small town not far from Nuremberg. But in any case, Kissinger was very good at learning how to sell himself to different people of all stations and classes. So right from the beginning, and that is obviously a very American thing, right? To take advantage of of to be able to manipulate yourself and your appearance in order to be all things to all people at different moments. And I think Kissinger excelled at that, whether it be working with liberal Republicans like the Rockefeller or as he moved to the right throughout his career, from Nixon to Reagan to the neocons.
So that gloomy Spenglerian thesis was from, what, 1950?
His thesis, yeah.
So what did he do? I mean, what did he do in the 50s after that thesis?
Well, he hung around Harvard. He got his PhD at Harvard, and 4 years later.
He didn't waste any time, 4 years.
He didn't waste any time, and he moved in three different directions simultaneously. He eventually got an instructorship at Harvard and then became a tenured professor in government, in the government department, and then established a base of power or influence there through running these international seminars. At the same time, he became an advisor to Nelson Rockefeller and working with the Council on Foreign Relations, which was kind of the liberal internationalist think tank. And he became an expert on nuclear power and deterrence through his relationship with Rockefeller and the Council on Foreign Relations. And at the same time, he deepened he already had a, you know, this is a thing I didn't really go into in the book because, you know, one can jump down the rabbit hole of the deep state. But Kissinger was very much implicated in military intelligence even before he went to Harvard. In Europe, he worked his way up through military intelligence and received a commendation. And then he came back and he sat on a number of advisory panels and boards for the National Security Council in the 1950s about psychological warfare. His advisors at Harvard were very much involved in the deep state. And then he used that as a jumping off point to become unofficial or part-time advisors to the Kennedy and Johnson administration. So he had, you know, by the 1950s, he was operating on a number of different levels within that Washington-Cambridge corridor.
Now, in the late 50s, he started hawking the line that was one of the things that John F. Kennedy campaigned on, the missile gap, which he knew to be untrue, correct?
Yes. He knew it to be untrue. He knew, but he repeatedly insisted that the Soviets were catching up or will catch up or about to catch up. And his main argument, well, and this actually started under Eisenhower, was that Eisenhower was betting too much on all-out retaliation against the Soviet first strike, that defense posture, if you let it stay as is, would eventually tilt power towards the Soviet Union because the United States would have increasingly less areas that it would be worth willing to launch a nuclear war over, particularly in the peripheral regions. So Kissinger, the main thing was Kissinger argued that you had to figure out a way to subdivide the threat. You had to figure out incremental actions that the U.S. could take short of an all-out retaliation to a Soviet first strike. And basically, when you think about it, it really only comes down to two things. One, you have to telegraph your willingness to engage in limited nuclear war, strategic nuclear war, or two, counterinsurgency or insurgency, small wars in what he called the gray areas of the world, including Indochina. When you think about it, those are really the only two ways that you could subdivide the threat. Is either, you know, and Kissinger became famous mostly for the first, for his advocacy of the need to embrace a willingness to have a limited nuclear war over areas of the world that we cared about.
I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, who's author of Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman, from Metropolitan Books. And of course, that, the talk about limited nuclear war and the German accent, you know, makes you think of Dr. Strangelove.
Yes, exactly. And he's often been tagged as that.
So as the 50s turned into the 60s, Kennedy came into office with at least more aggressive foreign policy stance rhetorically. How did Kissinger relate to the Kennedy administration?
Well, at first he was excited. He in a private lunch with Arthur Schlesinger, he talked about Kennedy might be the kind of leader that we're looking for that can bring new energy and vitality, that kind of thing. And he increasingly grew disillusioned we don't want to get into the details, the crisis in Germany and, you know, the Berlin Wall and all of that stuff. And then for a brief moment after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kissinger praised Kennedy. There's an epigraph that I use in the book where which Kissinger used in an article that basically celebrated Kennedy's facing down of Khrushchev, and it's the epigraph is, "There are two kinds of realists, those who manipulate facts and those who create them. The West requires nothing so much as men able to create their own reality." You know, that's a perfect synthesis or encapsulation of what I'm talking about. The idea, I mean, we kind of moved away from that discussion, but, you know, Kissinger's irrationalism and his subjective irrationalism manifested itself in this idea that he believed that reality exists, but he believed that we didn't have access to that reality other than the actions that we take in order to give ourselves an awareness of the reality. And so he becomes a very much what we might call a philosopher of the deed, that we need to take action not just to exercise our real power, but we need to take action to give us an awareness of our power. And that's been a constant strut of his diplomacy from the 1950s forward to today, actually.
You see, he's like Cheney and Rove and all before their time.
Yeah, and that's the argument of the book, that people there's a misrecognition of Kissinger as standing somehow opposed to the neocon adventurists, and in that misrecognition we can have an education, we can understand. I mean, that misrecognition says something about American power and American exceptionalism more broadly, and that's why studying Kissinger is important.
But the Cuban Missile Crisis, I mean, in some ways, as a perfectly Kissingerian thing, because on the one hand, Kennedy publicly was looking very tough, pushing the world to the brink of nuclear war. At the same time, he's back-channel negotiating with the Soviets.
Yeah, and Kissinger didn't know that when he wrote that praise song article about Kennedy. He only thought that Kennedy had stood down and stood Khrushchev down by offering an ultimatum and imposing the naval blockade. So it wasn't until later on that he got more of the details.
Kissinger was comfortable with both parties. I mean, he started out with Rockefeller and then had this flirtation with Kennedy. He was bipartisan.
Yeah, he was definitely a hawk. He was definitely helped push the debate to the right. He was a militarist, and he used terms. And one of the points of the books is that the basis of his criticism of Eisenhower and then later Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense, was pretty much the same terms that the neocons would use against Clinton. That we know they could project power, but they don't know why they're projecting power. They don't know, you know, they've mistaken information and technology for wisdom. You know, that's a kind of, every generation throws up a cohort of militarists that insists that we've got to return to our spirit, our intuition, our will. And Kissinger was that in the 50s and 60s. That said, he was squarely within the establishment, the foreign policy center, when the foreign policy establishment was much more coherent. He was an advisor to Rockefeller, who was a Republican, but Rockefeller was really just the center-right wing of the New Deal coalition, the Cold War coalition. And Kissinger advised Kennedy, he advised the LBJ administration. He had established contacts throughout the National Security Council of both of those administrations. That's what's amazing about him and why 1968 is so important, why when that coalition begins to fall apart, and it begins to fall apart earlier, but it manifests itself in Nixon getting the nomination of the Republican Party in the beginning of the summer of 68. And then Hubert Humphrey getting the nomination, but in an incredibly contested, acrimonious convention in Chicago that many people saw as ripping the Democrats apart. Robert Holbrooke, Kissinger's friend and an establishment diplomat, has this great story, which I recount in the book, of Kissinger and Holbrooke watching on TV in August in Martha's Vineyard, the Democratic convention. And this was also, so Nixon had already won the nomination for the Republicans, so Kissinger thought that he would move on over to the Democrats. But then he saw the convention, the Democrats ripping themselves apart inside and out. And he screamed or he yelled, and he had this little bit of a long, dark night of the soul. You know, I am lost, you know, where there'll be no place for me, and, you know, the center is disappearing. And he quickly accommodated himself to the new reality. He began making overtures to Richard Nixon, who he thought was a dangerous, resentful, unhinged right winger. And what he began to do in October and November was use his contacts in the outgoing Johnson administration to pass along knowledge, things that he knew about the Paris peace talks between Hanoi and Washington. And there's a lots of ins and outs to this, but the long story short is those talks derailed. Nixon won and appointed Kissinger not just national security advisor, but then told him to create the most strongest National Security Council in history, literally wrenching power from the State Department and the Department of Defense and turning the NSC not just into an advisory body, but a body that actually executes policy. And the swirl continues because having derailed the peace talks between Hanoi and Washington, Nixon and Kissinger had to restart them because they had to get out of the war too. And so they couldn't start bombing North Vietnam again. There was too much public opinion against that. So they started bombing Cambodia, and they started bombing Cambodia in secret. And they bombed Cambodia for 5 years. Hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed as a result. And that country was devastated, and it created the context for the rise of the Khmer Rouge and the genocidal Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot.
Let's step back a moment to the Paris peace talks issue. He committed what could be considered an act of treason by doing that, right?
Yes. People accused him of violating the Logan Act, which was one of the oldest laws. It dates back, I think, to the late 1700s, that private individuals can't engage in public diplomacy or can't influence the foreign policy of the United States through diplomacy. What he did was there were these secret peace talks going on in Paris that weren't so secret for the political establishment, but at least for the public. North Vietnam had agreed at the last moment to enter into formal peace talks after the election if Johnson stopped the bombing. Kissinger passed that information on to Nixon. Nixon then, through a third party, Anna Chenault, widow of Claire Chenault, deep ties in the Republican anti-communist right, let South Vietnam, let Saigon know that they'd get a better deal if they held off, or if they came out publicly against the peace talks, against that deal. And they did. And so it seemed like that whole truce that might have benefited Humphrey, who knows, could have, maybe not, maybe Nixon would have won anyway, it's impossible to say. But in any case, Nixon won by a very close margin. And then the war, by the time the war finally ended in 1973, at least U.S. involvement in the war, it did so on terms that were basically on the table in 1968.
That was the first part of an interview with Greg Grandin, a professor of history at NYU and author of Kissinger's Shadow from Metropolitan Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back with part two of the Grandin interview after a musical break.
Mercenaries are useless, disunited, unfaithful. They have nothing more to keep them in a battle other than a meager wage, which is just about enough to make them want to kill for you, but not enough to make them want to die for you.
That was some of Mercenaries by John Cale, recorded in 1979. And now on to part two of the interview with Greg Grandin, author of Kissinger's Shadow. Okay, now back to the secret bombing of Cambodia, which is certainly not a secret to the Cambodians. That was an incredibly elaborate deception, right? They falsifying records, destroying records. You know, there you have a quote in the book that Henry said, from experience, no doubt, that sometimes you don't know whether documents are there to provide an alibi or whether they're actually recording policy deliberations.
I love that.
That's an amazing quote. But, you know, the deception was incredibly elaborate and went on for quite a long time, right?
Yeah, well, they had to do it off the books because neither Congress would have approved it, and the public, they were afraid of the public reaction. And so Kissinger, his military aide in the National Security Council, who was Alexander Haig, and an Air Force colonel, got together and they worked up a very elaborate protocol. They had to be able to do it, two things. One, they had to be able to bomb Cambodia, but they had to be able to account for the use of munitions, spare parts, and fuel. So they came up with this very complicated thing in which Kissinger was literally picking the targets in the basement of the White House, not the Pentagon, not the Air Force. The coordinates were couriered to South Vietnam. At the last minute, they were switched out, and B-52 pilots that had thought they were on their way to bomb South Vietnam were diverted into Cambodia. And then all of the paperwork was destroyed and burnt. They kept a furnace going 24 hours a day to burn the documents. There's some pretty amazing descriptions from Hal Knight, who was a whistleblower in 1973 about this. Now, it gets complicated because that was called Operation Menu. That went on, that using that protocol went on from March 1969 towards the end of 1970. U.S. invades Cambodia in the spring of 1970, and that creates, there's a coup in Cambodia. Lots of things begin to happen. From 1970 to 1973, the U.S. continues to bomb Cambodia, not necessarily using those Operation Menu secret off-the-books double-keeping protocol. And technically, it wasn't secret, but the press didn't really pay attention to it. So the real covert bombing of Cambodia takes place from 69 to 70, but the bombing itself takes place for 5 years.
What was the point of it? The official to deny sanctuary to the North Vietnamese, right?
Well, officially, that was, to...
Well, officially, it didn't exist at first, but...
Well, right, to disrupt the Ho Chi Minh Trail and try to stop the, influx of munitions and material to South Vietnam. Another very explicit reason among the administration was to have a show of force for North Vietnam to get them back to the bargaining table. This was part of what becomes known as the madman theory, that Nixon is so crazy, he's willing to do anything. It's a kind of vulgarization of game theory and rational choice theory, right? Figuring out ways to telegraph the irrationality of your opponent to force a certain outcome. And then also there were a lot of subsidiary reasons. The bombing of Cambodia becomes very much bound up in Kissinger's bureaucratic infighting within the National Security Council. Look, he's Jewish. He's an academic. He comes from Harvard. He's the outsider with all of those Prussians that Nixon had around him, Ehrlichman and, Arnold Haldeman and all of these guys, Al Haig. So he had to prove that he was tough. And being the most ultra in wanting to bomb Cambodia and wanting to do it in complete secrecy allowed him to prove that to those guys that he was the hawk of hawks. And that's why, and he also used it, one of the reasons why he began to sacrifice all of his civilian aides, people like Mort Halperin, eventually, Tony Lake, all of these other people, it's all because that they were civilians. They were, they might have been part of the establishment, but they were too intelligent for Nixon. They believed in facts. They believed in, of rational decision making. So Kissinger was able to use being ultra on Cambodia as a way of drawing him closer to Nixon, because Nixon was the single source of his power base.
But you also say that South Vietnam was part of the Nixon administration's southern strategy. It had domestic angle too.
Yes. So we know about Nixon. Nixon wins in 68 in a three-way race where a lot of votes go to George Wallace. And Nixon is worried about the right wing and the Republican Party going into 72. And the Southern strategy isn't just about winning over racist Democrats. It's also about figuring out how to keep the right wing Republicans in the party and not have a third party. And part of this brutal, tough, hard line in Cambodia, in Laos, and what people call the tar baby option in Southern Africa, which was basically aligning with white supremacy, was clearly for domestic politics with an eye on 72. So Kissinger was constantly being sent to California by Nixon as an emissary to the right wing to speak to people like Bob Hope, to speak to people like Ronald Reagan. At one point after the invasion of Laos and after the invasion of Cambodia, which were disastrous in all sorts of ways, Kissinger tells Reagan, look, you know, how can you say there's no difference between Humphrey and Nixon? If it wasn't Nixon, we wouldn't have had Laos. We wouldn't have had Cambodia. So there's a way in which Kissinger and Nixon don't create the crack up of the post-war consensus, but they accelerate it. And then they quickly learn how to leverage that polarization in the United States through foreign policy. So foreign policy and militarism and war and brutalism, to put quite frankly, the idea that we're going to bomb the shit out of some poor third world country just to satisfy Ronald Reagan, is subordinated to domestic politics. That's nothing new, obviously, but it takes on a different balance after the 60s, where that cleavage domestically is both taken advantage of through foreign policy, and then foreign policy worsens the cleavage.
I'm still reeling from the thought that the good opinion of Bob Hope was an important thing for making policy. Now let's turn to Latin America, where Kissinger had some of his more dastardly doings. We just learned officially that Pinochet ordered the assassination of Letelier. But it wasn't just Chile, right? It wasn't just Pinochet. He was involved across the continent.
Yeah, yeah. Guatemala isn't a genocide that Kissinger is associated with. He's associated with genocides in Bangladesh and East Timor and in Cambodia. But I found these documents that nobody has commented on, and I talk about them in the book a little bit, where in the early 1970s, when he's chair of the infamous 40 Committee, which is a kind of interagency coordinating committee of all the spook operations, you know, in CIA and National Security Council and whatnot, where there's a lot of pressure to pull back support for the Guatemalan military because it's clear that the death squads are killing everybody, not just communists and not just insurgents. Kissinger squashes that initiative in the 1970s, and then he and Al Haig are actually instrumental in passing on information of so-called subversives to the death squad intelligence agency in the 1970s. So in some ways, I think Guatemala is not a genocide that actually should be associated with, even though it happens in 82, should be somehow associated with Kissinger. But besides from that, Kissinger, in 71, he orders a coup in Bolivia, and the CIA comply. He's involved in the coups in all of those Latin American countries that come right after that, in Uruguay in 73, and in Chile in 73, obviously, in Argentina in 76. And then he is very instrumental in providing legitimacy, or at least cover, for what becomes Operation Condor. You know, we haven't found the smoking gun. I know that smoking gun linking Pinochet directly to the assassination of Orlando Letelier just was released. But, you know, I mean, there's enough circumstantial evidence to talk about, to understand Kissinger's role in constantly morally supporting people like Pinochet. What's interesting about it, and one of the things that I kind of noticed and nobody has commented on, and I discuss it a little bit in the book, is Kissinger turns to Latin America after Cuba forces his hand in Angola. There's a way in which Kissinger is kind of willing to normalize relationship with Cuba in 74, particularly during the first couple of years of the Ford administration. But then when Cuba intervenes in Angola, and by sending military troops to Angola to fight the U.S.-backed mercenaries and Southern African troops, and basically saving Angola for the National Liberation Movement there, and threatening to move on to Rhodesia, Kissinger really is forced to do a complete about-face in Southern Africa. Mm. You know, he tours Southern Africa in the middle of 1976. He dons a dashiki. He says,
are there pictures of that?
Yeah, yeah, there are. Jet Magazine. Jet Magazine interviews him. He said, we have no desire to impose a single economic system. You know, because there was a lot of these kind of post-colonial socialist states, you know, that had some amalgam of state socialism. He says Africa for the African. So Cuba basically forces Kissinger to do a complete turnaround and begin to negotiate the exit of the white supremacists in Rhodesia. But you could, there's almost an exact correlation, and that's when he turns to the Men of Condor. It's almost like Cuba pushes back Kissinger in Southern Africa, and that leads to Kissinger double down on Operation Condor, which ultimately is directed at Cuba, right, and all of Cuba's potential influences throughout South America. It's just like, you know, one of the things that when people talk about Kissinger in Latin America, I think it needs to be paired with what he was doing in Southern Africa and his getting pushed out of Southern Africa by Cuba.
He had that philosophy that you don't necessarily strike in the region you're having trouble, right? You can create some sort of secondary crisis somewhere. And what there's that quote, what it does, it, whether we were right or wrong is a secondary matter?
Well, yeah, it's an incredible quote. So, you know, so this is all after he's out of office. Kissinger becomes very much involved. I mean, obviously becomes incredibly influential and powerful through Kissinger Associates, a private consultancy that we don't have access to, but he, deep ties in China and Russia and Saudi Arabia. But he also becomes an important, he returns to his role as a defense intellectual. And he's key in the militarization of the Gulf. He is, the first Gulf War, there were a lot of conservatives, Cold War conservatives, who were a little nervous about George H.W. Bush's buildup of troops in Saudi Arabia to liberate Kuwait from Iraq. Jean Kirkpatrick, for instance, said, you know, she wrote an op-ed, what does it matter who pumps the gas? You know, it doesn't matter. Let them do whatever they want. We'll have access to the gas. We have to focus on ourselves. We have to she actually used phrases like we have to nation, she didn't use the phrase nation build, but in effect, she had the sentiment that we had a tend to our own problems domestically and step back now that the Cold War was over. Kissinger was first out of the gate in attacking what he described as these new isolationists among conservatives and establishing the need to go into Kuwait. And then that quote that you mentioned is from the mid-1990s when Clinton was periodically lobbing cruise missiles into Iraq for any number of reasons, but mostly supposedly to force Iraq to open up to UN inspectors. Kissinger says that he met with the Clinton administration and he said, this isn't about inspectors. It doesn't really matter. It's not about weapons of mass destruction. This is about your need to match your actions to your objection, your objectives. And if we and how are we going to deal with the leader who we say we are not willing to negotiate with? We have to be able to break his back and his will. And then he says that great line that this is what Nixon and I tried to do in Vietnam, and whether we got it right or wrong is really secondary. Now, you know, when you think about that, whether we got it right or wrong is really secondary, it's not really that crazy a quotation when one considers that throughout Kissinger's whole history, he's advocated for a philosophy of diplomacy in which action creates meaning. And he was saying it then, that's exactly what he was saying, that we have to be able to break the back of Saddam Hussein to convince ourselves that we have the will to be able to break the back of people like Saddam Hussein. That's the circularity, right? We have to project power to create purpose. Our purpose is to project power. We have to be able to prove that we are willing to act, and the best way to prove that we are willing to act is to act. So it's that circularity that Kissinger is very explicit about that I think reflects some primal merry-go-round within American interventionism.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it doesn't seem to have as his intention increasing the rate of return on capital. There's this sense in which it's all about just acting heroically in the world in some sort of romantic quester.
Yeah, to show, he says, there's no such thing as real power. We come to understand there might be real power and there might be reality. I do believe there was a slight distinction between the crazy neocons and Reagan. I think they were one strung up the metaphysical ladder. Kissinger believed that reality existed. He often talked about the necessities, you know, in that heavy prose of the 1950s of his undergraduate thesis. Human beings live in this dialectic of, and this is very Sartrean, we live in this dialectic of freedom and necessity. The world imposes limits, you know, whether it be other people or other nations, but within those limits, we have room to act. And we can't really have an understanding of that reality until we act. Again, it's Kissinger's philosophy of history, but I think it opens up to a larger component of some of the ideology that drives U.S. foreign policy.
Stepping back a little bit in history, the right turned against him in the late 70s, right? Ronald Reagan portrayed him as weak, sellout, let the Soviets get ahead of us and all that. And Kissinger was able to adapt to that, right?
Yeah, even in the Ford administration, Rumsfeld and Cheney, they're sensing which way the wind... I mean, Kissinger calls Rumsfeld the most despicable person he ever met in government. Rumsfeld and Cheney team up against Kissinger and isolate him. And the Ford administration, they basically they identified him as an appeaser for detente, a sinner for not believing in American exceptionalism, and a loser for Vietnam. And you know, at this point, Kissinger is trying to reality has imposed a bit of caution and a bit of I don't want to say humility, but, you know, has constricted his range of maneuvers, and he is making these deals. He is talking a lot about interdependence. And the right comes up, Team B, that alternative intelligence committee that the neocons set up in the last years of the Ford administration to prove that the CIA was too cautious. That was really all, a move against Kissinger and detente. And Kissinger does make his peace. This is the thing about Kissinger, and this is the thing that makes him both, I think, exceptional and exemplary. Other post-war policymakers and intellectuals, be they Democrats or Republicans, all eventually come to break with the national security state. George Kennan, Arthur Schlesinger, or they come to be critical, extremely so. Kennan, by the Reagan administration, was calling the Reagan New Right ignorant and arrogant and dangerous and unhinged and all of that stuff. Not Kissinger. What's specific about Kissinger is that with every lurch to the right, Kissinger lurches with it. And that's one of the things that tracking his own trajectory opens up to that right wing drift, since Vietnam forward, right, that we are now living under.
I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, author of Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statement from Metropolitan Books. So what precisely is the relation of Kissinger to the Bush-era neocons? There are similarities but differences, right?
Well, I think there's a real political differences. I think, I think that they did identify detente as a threat, especially if they wanted to be on constant war mobilization footing. I think there were differences over Israel, and I tried actually to avoid that question because... it could kind of become its own that question, and Kissinger's relationship to Israel is complicated, but I think that they saw Kissinger as not, even though Kissinger has strong alliances and loyalties to Israel, I think the neocons had real differences with him that they weren't strong enough in some ways, but the point isn't to deny those differences, but just to understand how in some ways, the neocons, when they're critiquing Kissinger or when they're critiquing the Carter administration or when they're critiquing Clinton, they're using terms that are very similar to the ones that Kissinger used in the 1950s against the Eisenhower administration, right? Every generation throws up this new cohort of militarists that are reacting to what they perceive as the over-civilization of society or the over-bureaucratization of society. Kissinger did it in the 50s, and the neocons did it against him in the late 70s. So, there is real political differences, but there's also, I think, an ideological affinity that is more important.
And so, as we draw to a close, let's talk about the meaning of Kissingerism. You say at one point that it's kind of hard to pin down precisely what Kissingerism was, but you also say that perhaps one of his great achievements was restoring the imperial presidency at its moment of greatest vulnerability in the 1970s after the loss in Vietnam. So what is the legacy of Henry?
Well, I think it is that. I think that Kissinger simultaneously presided over the crack-up of the old national security state based on elite planning and bipartisanship and public support. Even as that was unraveling, he lays the foundation for its reformation and its rehabilitation in a new form, able to move forward in a post-Vietnam War. And that's, there's a lot of different dimensions of this kind of restored imperial state or national security state. But it's the dependence on ever more spectacular acts of violence that is as much instructive for the domestic population as it is for our supposed enemies, and a deepening reliance on covert activities in order to bypass an increasingly meddlesome Congress and curious press corps. perhaps more important, also the willingness and subordination of foreign policy to leverage domestic polarization, right? And that creates its own logic to some degree, that self-fulfilling logic. But Kissinger in some ways is metaphysical. It's the legacy is more metaphysical than any of those things. It's this, it's a form of kind of irrational militarism that understands the projection of power is needed to establish our sense of selves, our understanding of selves, our meaning in the world. And 9/11, you know, whatever differences neocons had with Kissinger prior to 9/11, there's almost a perfect fusion of sentiment and strategy after 9/11, where, you know, all of they all come together. Kissinger is a big supporter of the Bush administration's not drive into not just Afghanistan, Iraq, but he early on he wanted to go into Yemen, Pakistan, and beyond, and as part of what he called a revolution in international relations. So I think Kissinger's legacy is Kissinger's shadow is quite long.
It's interesting that, you know, back in the 60s, he felt he had to bomb Cambodia secretly because public opinion might not tolerate it. And then, you know, this has become so routine now that when Clinton launched cruise missiles against Iraq, you know, scores of them, nobody cared.
Yeah, well, the point counterpoint to that is Cambodia versus Gulf War One, right? So Cambodia was done in secret because they were afraid of public dissent. Gulf War One was preceded by months of public debate and growing public support of George H.W. Bush. And then Kissinger himself was everywhere. He was on ABC, he was on CBS, he was on NBC, he was on PBS. He was writing in newspapers. You know, on the first day of the bombing, he told Dan Rather on CBS News, "Oh, I think it's going well." And in some ways, that techno display of, you know, night vision goggles broadcast to the whole world through CNN and cable news was the perfect inversion of Cambodia in some way. So the fulfillment of the logic.
Yeah, I saw him on CNN during the first Gulf War, and he actually said at one point, "The beauty of this is because of CNN, the whole world is watching this through American eyes."
So if you think of Kissinger in Cambodia and North Vietnam and Laos as the opposite of a realist, right, trying to bomb countries, you're refusing to believe that the overwhelming might of the United States couldn't break the will of these third, as he could constantly called it, third-rate countries. And they didn't. They refused to break. North Vietnam refused to break, certainly. For a very brief moment, Cambodia was the world that Kissinger always wanted to live in, right? He wanted to live in a world where you bomb the shit out of a country and they withdraw. And so for a very short period of time, that was the fulfillment of Kissinger. And we've seen the quarter century kind of outcome of that, where we don't, I mean, we're spinning around in circles and nobody knows what to do anywhere. So, you know, that didn't last very long. But yes, it is a good example of the how Kissinger comes out of the shadows in some ways.
And then, you know, finally, this don't want to personalize these things too much, but this deeply evil man is now going to Yankees games with Samantha Power. And you see Hillary Clinton writing a very flattering review of his most recent book with a terrifying title, World Order, you know, in the Washington Post. I mean, so he's just like a hero. All these crimes have been forgotten, and he's just the great man and the wise man and the statesman among statesmen.
Yeah, so he's outlasted all of them, and things are so bad that he can be held up, you know, as a kind of avatar of gravitas or purpose, even though the whole point is that there was no content to the purpose. But yes, he gets, it's in some ways, it's a little bit of a public ritual in which Samantha Power, who wrote about the genocides, you know, came to fame writing and critiquing the genocides that Kissinger helped bring about, is sidling up next to him and, you know, bantering at a Yankee Red Sox game as if they were some geopolitical Tracy and Hepburn. There was all sorts of innuendo about, you know, who the realist supports the Yankees, but the idealist supports the underdog Red Sox. I mean, it is so infuriating. That's actually was the photo that photo of them at that Yankee game drove me so over the edge. That's what, one of the things that prompted writing this book.
Yeah, it was just deeply revolting to see it. Yeah, and that the big issue is the Red Sox versus the Yankees, not that she was here with this mass murderer.
Yes, I know. It was amazing.
Unbelievable. And then, of course, Hillary Clinton, who, you know, now speaks of coercive diplomacy in relation to Iran. I mean, it's very, very Kissingerian. You know, she started her career on the Watergate Impeachment Committee, and here she is kind of repeating Kissinger-Nixon foreign policy thinking.
Yeah, that's right. It's appropriate because it was Bill Clinton who began the rehabilitation for the Democrats of Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger, I mostly talk about his role as a public intellectual after leaving office, but as running Kissinger Associates, Kissinger was very instrumental in negotiating NAFTA under George H.W. Bush. And then when Clinton came to power, Kissinger advised Clinton on how to get it passed through Congress. And it was actually Kissinger. It was Kissinger who advised Clinton to prioritize NAFTA rather than Hillary care. And so I don't know if that led to any resentments, but obviously they've been overcome. But it was really the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton's administration, that began the rehabilitation of Kissinger for the Democrats.
And of course, the Clinton Foundation is somewhat like Kissinger Associates, only much more public and with much more money.
Right. I mean, there was some conservative senator when Kissinger was being considered for chairing the 9/11 commission. And of course, he had to drop out because he refused to reveal his client list. Some conservative senator, I can't remember from where, said, you know, that client list is the most sought after document in the country. You know, he even offered to like just review it in some safe room up on the fifth floor of the inner ring of the Pentagon. And Kissinger refused and declined taking the chairmanship.
That was part two of an interview with Greg Grandin, professor of history at NYU, and author of Kissinger's Shadow, published by Metropolitan Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Nutted by Reality, by Nick Lowe from 1978. Till next week, bye.
Well, I heard they castrated Castro. I heard they cut off everything he had. What a dirty, low-down thing to do to mess him up like that. They dumped him in the jungle, in the land of the sugar cane. Ever since the day they fiddled around, said it ain't never been the same. I say, ooh-la. I say, ooh-la. I say, ooh-la. Well, I heard they castrated Castro because he was the people's friend. They told him once and they told him twice, said I ain't gonna tell you again. They put a bit of pressure on him, that's when he told them what they could do. So the word came down from the noise in town, set up a jungle rendezvous. I said, ooh-la. I said, ooh-la. We said, ooh-la. He had been living in a different world, and he was not to